You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. The Northern Ireland conflict, also known as the Troubles, was a 30-year fight between the overwhelmingly Protestant Unionists, who wanted to remain part of the United Kingdom, and the largely Roman Catholic Nationalists, who wanted Northern Ireland to become part of the Republic of Ireland.
Get down! Get down, everybody, get down!
Between 1968 and 1998, families were ripped apart by borders and bombs. In the three decades of violence, 3,600 people were killed and 30,000 were wounded.
After months of negotiation, another breakthrough was announced in the Northern Ireland peace process.
That's me, reporting for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer in 1999, and yes, I sound very different. What does an outsider pick up when covering a story like this one? There were physical things, walls that marched through the middle of neighborhoods, murals of mourned martyrs announcing a neighborhood's allegiance to one side or another in the bloodletting. What you found in people, all kinds of people, was the tension that comes from an almost unbearable mix of pride, frustration, anger, sadness, and resignation. Along with the grievance and the loss, the worry about what happened next, was the sometimes unbearable feeling that it just wasn't going to end. For Irish citizens like Fintan O'Toole, border crossings and custom stops were regular events.
There were times when, you know, you're just crossing the border and you're stopped by armed troops who stick a machine gun into the car, you know.
That lasted until the United Kingdom and the Republic of Ireland signed a peace deal in 1998.
Lift the focus on these islands remains in the past will become the future, and that is something no one desires.
Known as the Good Friday Agreement, it gave Northern Irish the choice of citizenship in the UK, Ireland, or both, and it made the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland all but invisible. Brexit could jeopardize that hard-won agreement. The Republic of Ireland is still a member of the EU. So now that the United Kingdom has left, it could get tougher for Northern Irish people and commerce to move freely between the two countries. Fintan O'Toole is now a columnist for the Irish Times, and he's been following the recent Brexit news closely. Welcome back to World Affairs.
Thanks very much, Ray.
Well, on the streets of Dublin, can you feel anything different? Is the air different? Is there some sense that something momentous has changed, or are we a long way away from that?
You know, it's a very strange thing, Ray. As you said, it's still quite hard for people to get their head around because, you know, there are, I suppose most of the population of Ireland, you know, was born after Ireland and the United Kingdom joined the EU. So, you know, it's something that people have just taken for granted for all of their lives, and now, of course, it's over. And you know, it's funny the way things hit people. You know, the thing you hear people talking about are things like, for example, I tried to order something on Amazon, and you know, they tried to charge me an extra 10 euro, you know, why? And you say, well, because Amazon UK, that's where we get our stuff through Amazon UK, and that's now outside the European Union. And now they're charging all sorts of, you know, taxes and fees on top of it. The free movement of goods has stopped, you know. It's the little things like that. Things like the fact that there are new shipping companies moving in and creating new shipping routes. So most Irish goods traffic, you know, has gone from, you know, the east coast of Ireland to Holyhead in Wales, and then down to Dover, and then over from Dover to Calais into France, and then you go wherever you need to go in Europe. That's very difficult now because it means that although, you know, the Irish truck drivers are EU citizens, they're having to go into the queue with all the British truck drivers, and there are huge delays. So you suddenly have new shipping routes opened up from the south of the country, going to France and going to Spain. You know, and so it's people are just beginning to really get their heads around it, you know, it's something that people would like to be over because, you know, frankly, people are bored with it. It's gone on so long, but are also realizing that this is something that whose long-term implications we don't really yet know.
Well, until December 31st, there had never been a moment when Ireland and Britain were not in the EU together. So as Ireland got richer through the 90s, the 00s, and into the teens, even through the crisis, even through the troubles, a lot of things evolved without any, even a lot of conscious thought. The assumption that you could jump on a ferry and be in Liverpool in a few hours, that you could jump on a train and be in Belfast in a few hours. That just ended kind of abruptly on December 31st. And now suddenly all these new things have to happen. Was there a sense that Ireland was playing a strong hand at the bargaining table as we were figuring out what this after New Year's Day world was going to look like, how it was going to work?
Yeah, you know, I remember when the Brexit vote came in, I mean, there was this sense of oh my God, what's going to happen on this island? You know, how are we going to deal with this? And a real sense of powerlessness, you know, because obviously people in Northern Ireland had voted. They'd voted to stay in the European Union, of course, but they had a vote at least, you know, because they were part of the UK. But, the majority of the island is the Republic of Ireland, which is an independent country and quite rightly didn't have a vote. We were looking for a vote, but nevertheless, it was like we were collateral damage in this completely different war that was going on between half of England and the European Union. And it had huge implications for us, but it sort of felt at that moment like we were powerless to really affect it. And what's been remarkable really over the last few years since then is the degree to which Ireland actually was able to influence events and was able to influence them, ironically, through being in the European Union. You know, the very fact that you're in the club and that you're the sort of favoured child, if you like. I mean, Ireland is small. It's relatively weak. It's 1% of the European economy. You know, it's tiny. But it turned out that the Europeans actually, you know, took the Irish question incredibly seriously and really pushed very hard to make sure that Ireland wasn't sort of isolated. And in particular, as you mentioned, this border question, you know, which was such a huge one for Irish people, that was going to be right at the top of the EU agenda. It wasn't going to be something that would be, you know, they deal with trade and they deal with all these kind of economic questions and they say, oh, and by the way, there's the Irish border. I mean, they made it one of the absolute central issues for the European Union in terms of a deal with the British. And that actually has been an extraordinary experience for Ireland, because it's not something that small countries are used to. You know, they're not used to getting their way. They're used to saying, well, if the big boys are clashing, you know, we're just going to be caught in the middle and our interests are not going to be looked out for by anybody. And I think I'm usually kind of very critical of Irish governments. That's my job, you know, but they're actually, you know, the Irish diplomacy has been really very, very effective in terms of identifying what were the big things that Ireland needed to get out of this, the damage limitation, and how was that going to be done. And I think on January 1st, we did realize, actually, you know what, there's nothing good about this, but from an Irish point of view, it is the least damaging outcome that we could possibly have got.
It's interesting to hear you reflect on that sense of what being small means to Ireland. Fewer people than in New York City, just a little bit more than Los Angeles. But there's more to that story. I mean, there's a lot of history here, and certainly from the point of view of people living in the Republic of Ireland, a lot of bad history, not being able to get its own way in its relationships with London for centuries, not just since 1973. Did that add a level of complexity, a level of challenge to this that might not have been there if Ireland was, you know, talking about cross North Sea trade with Holland or with Belgium?
You know, what it did raise was it raised the stakes, absolutely. You know, so I think you're absolutely right in the way you framed the question, you know, that normally these things would be, you know, you'd say it's regrettable, but, you know, okay, it's about money, it's about trade. These are important things, but they don't feel like existential issues of identity, right? Nobody's going to go out and kill somebody over, you know, whether there's a customs charge on fish. You know, they might argue over it and they might get angry about it, but it's not the sort of stuff that sort of leads to the kind of catastrophic outcomes that we've had on the island of Ireland for long periods. So the big issue for most Irish people was, look, how can we make sure that the extraordinary achievements, which actually, after all, were joint British-Irish achievements, you know, the Irish government, British government worked brilliantly together with a lot of help from the United States. But, you know, the key relationship was London, Dublin. They worked together to create a peaceful solution in Northern Ireland. And they built up incredible trust and you know, really kind of genuine friendship in doing that. And it was successful. That's not without qualification. Nothing ever is. But, you know, it's, if you look at world history, in the period since 1998, when the Belfast Agreement was signed, you know, it stands out as one of the great achievements of international diplomacy. And it's had a huge effect on the island. And one of the reasons is exactly as you were saying. So when I was a kid, you know, I grew up in Dublin. If I went to Belfast, well, we went to Belfast to buy clothes because they were cheaper. I came back wearing about five layers of clothes. I mean, you used to sort of die of the heat on the train because your mother would put five layers of clothes on you to try to fool the customs officials, you know, so you wouldn't have to pay taxes. The customs officials, of course, knew exactly what was going on, but they went. But nevertheless, you were stopped by customs officials. You could be stopped by the police. Might get on the train. You know, there was this sense, and that lasted really a very long time because, as well as, you know, the custom stuff, of course, then you had the trouble. So you had security stuff, you had the army, you know, there were times when, you know, you're just crossing the border and you're stopped by armed troops who stick a machine gun into the car, you know. That disappeared, you know, and it disappeared because of the peace agreement, but also then because of the single European market, right? So there's no need for customs, there's no need for troops. So what does that mean? It means you get on the train, and I remember finding myself in about, you know, I think it was just about 2010 or something. I was just kind of going up to some business in Belfast, and I was just looking out the window, you know, and I just realized I can't remember where the border was. I actually, you know, and it was like one of those wonderful moments in your life where you realize, I know it's around here somewhere, you know, whereas for most of my life, I would have known exactly where it was because you wouldn't have any choice but to know. And that has a huge effect on people. You know, it doesn't seem like a big thing, but what it means is that ordinary life can restart on the island. You know, people can go to school in one part of the, you know, over the border and live on the other side. They can work. They can, you know, meet their friends. They can, you know, there's a whole set of social relationships that get built up, and it's just ordinary life. But ordinary life is a sort of wonderful thing, you know. When you've had its absence, you really realize just how brilliant this is. And people didn't want to lose that. You know, there was this real sense that whatever else happens with this thing, we're not going to stand for it. You know, we're not going to let the Brexit thing take this away. So what Ireland did was really pushed very, very hard with the Europeans, with the French, with the Germans, with the Italians, everybody else. And, you know, they were working on this actually before the referendum. I mean, they were really very good, saying, look, if this happens, you have to be on our side, or you have to say to the Brits, no, this is not going to happen. You're not going to be allowed to do this. And what's ended up, it's probably very hard for people outside to just realize how extraordinary it is, what, you know, where we've ended up on January 1st. So where we've ended up now is that it's one of the great ironies of Brexit, which is the British have ended up with a free trade area smaller than their country. They talk about global Britain, and they talk about, you know, expansion and the sort of almost, you know, Empire 2.0, all that stuff. What's happened is Northern Ireland, which is, you know, is a part of the United Kingdom. It's as much a part of the United Kingdom, legally at least, as California is part of the United States, you know. That's like the United States saying, well, actually, California can have a completely different trading relationship and customs relationship with the rest of the world than the rest of America does, you know. So, you know, Northern Ireland now is effectively still in the European single market, still in the European Customs Union. Which means, of course, this might sound very technical. What it means is that border hasn't come back, right? So you can get in your truck if you're, you know, delivering goods. If you're a, you know, food producer in Northern Ireland and you want to sell to the Dublin market, you just get in your truck and you come down and you sell it, right? There's no issue. But if you're in Scotland or you're in England and you're trying to import stuff into Northern Ireland, which is part of your own territory, you have to fill out effectively customs forms. You have to go through what's now called a border in the Irish Sea, you know? And that's an extraordinary thing to have happen.
Wasn't that just what Boris Johnson was trying to avoid earlier on in the negotiations? It seemed he was adamant that just that effect you describe would not happen, that Northern Ireland would remain firmly in commercial terms, in legal and sovereignty terms, in the UK rather than related to the Republic of Ireland.
So, you know, both Theresa May, who was the first post-Brexit prime minister, and Boris Johnson, of course, who succeeded, they both used almost exactly the same phrase. They both said, no British prime minister could ever agree to this. You know? It was as absolute as that. And yet, what did they do? They agreed to it, you know. And this is the great irony of Brexit, you know, that it's supposed to be all about taking back control. It's supposed to be all about kind of repatriating powers to London. But of course, in the real world, what it's actually meant is that in a way, Britain wasn't even strong enough to be able to say, this is our bottom line on this and we're not budging. They had to budge on it because the Europeans basically said there is no conceivable deal. We're not even really seriously talking about it. Unless you guarantee that there will be no hard border on the island of Ireland. And so the British have ended up doing something which their prime ministers successively said could never be done. And I don't think they've fully thought through the implications of it.
Let's talk a little bit about the more social, cultural Ireland of the imagination, the Ireland that lives in your head part of all of this. I was struck reporting on both sides of the border in the early 90s, by how much the two polities had evolved away from each other, that the troubles, the decades of social strife in Northern Ireland had created people who shared this small island with each other, but had their backs to each other in a lot of ways. I would ask people in towns, in the town plaza, in towns on both sides of the border, do you go to the other side? I'd ask people in the Republic, do you go to Ulster? They said no. When I crossed the old border stations, they were like something you'd see in a crossing between East and West Germany at the height of the Cold War. Big metal things with guard towers and enormous iron barriers that would raise up to keep a car from just rolling through from one side to the other. I was struck by the degree to which people had done without each other. You mentioned going to buy clothes, but it was just as common to speak to an Ulsterman who'd say he'd never been to Dublin, even during a time when cultural festivals and the profile of the Republic of Ireland was rising on the world stage. Did that create a kind of undertow that made it impossible to re-estrange these two people? Was it no longer in the cards to make a hard border, in part because the two people had kind of gotten enmeshed in ways that they weren't even conscious of?
I think that puts it beautifully and is very, very perceptive, you know, and in my experience, completely right, you know. So you're absolutely right about the alienation that happened. It was, of course, within Northern Ireland, of course, itself, you had the alienation, you know, you had this sort of division crudely between Protestant and Catholic. But also then you had this alienation on the island, you know, you had the sense that the North was different, which was there already, I suppose, historically, for obvious reasons, because it was more industrial, more connected to Britain and the Empire, more Protestants, of course. So it was there already, but there's no question but that partition, whether people agree with it or disagree with it, it solidifies different identities, right? So different political institutions, different media, you know, different ways of identifying yourself. And that then was completely solidified by the Troubles, right? There was an obvious enough reason why, you know, people from Dublin didn't go to Belfast, you know, during the Troubles. They were afraid. Sometimes over afraid. You know, people maybe sometimes exaggerate the degree of danger that they might have faced, but that's the way people are, isn't it? You know, to be honest, Belfast or Derry, you know, or most of those border towns were not particularly attractive places to go for a vacation, you know, during that period. I mean, they were, you know, you don't particularly want to be on your holidays in a place with armed troops and the prospect of bombs going off. So you're completely right about that. And that's why there's been such pleasure, really, over that period between, between 98, you know, when the peace agreement was signed, all the towers, the military towers came down. And then that's when you actually, it's almost like that's when the island really realized what being in the European Union meant. This is a great irony because it was like, oh, if you take away the troubles and you take away the military stuff and you get the army out of there, then there's nothing between us. There's like, you know, we're part of the same polity. And yes, of course, there's still all those differences. But on a day-to-day level, the only thing that people would have been really conscious of if you crossed the border and were doing business was that you had to change the currency. But, you know, people get used to that very quickly. They just have, British sterling and Irish euro or European euro in their pockets. You know, it's just the way people get on. It was never a big issue. So that's what felt very precious, actually, because it's sort of, it's a huge human achievement. You know, it's the way people actually recover a sense of being together, sharing space. I suppose that's the key idea in this, isn't it? It's not about sort of claiming this territory or that territory anymore. It's about we're human beings who share a space. And that was the real violence of the threat of Brexit, right? Which was that it was being done by people who just didn't know anything about that. And if they did know about it, just didn't care about it. You know, the sense of just, we really, you know, that's your problem. It's not our problem. You know, we're putting up this border and, you know, just deal with it. That was very offensive, actually, you know, and I think I don't feel any sense of schadenfreude or any sense of triumph out of any of this, because it's a sad story, the Brexit story. But from an Irish perspective, this is a relatively young state, a small state, a weak state, a state that for most of its existence was incredibly poor. And there is a real sense, actually, of saying, wow, you know, this is maybe the first time in our history we were faced with a major international crisis and we won. You know, we actually got the thing we really needed to get. And we got it against the wishes of Britain. And that's not an anti-British point at all, but it's simply, as you were saying earlier, you know, the history of the relationship is big country, little country. Well, who usually wins that when there's a conflict of interest? The big country wins. This is the first time the small country's won.
For much of the 20th century, Ireland was still intermeshed with England and Scotland, certainly, in ways large and small that a lot of the outside world didn't know about. I mean, it was pretty easy to move to the United Kingdom from the Republic of Ireland. You could vote in local elections. It was pretty frictionless. I met a lot of Irish people in Liverpool. I knew a lot of Irish people in London. And yet, there was a lot of residue of that old conflict between the two countries. With the Republic in the EU and Britain out of it, does the relationship with Brussels and Strasbourg, with Paris and Amsterdam and Berlin continue to solidify, continue to integrate with Irish kids going to universities on the continent, but not as easily going to London or Edinburgh or Cardiff? Does Ireland now enter into a new phase of its relationship to Europe because it's no longer a kind of Bobsy twin with its closest neighbor?
I think it does. And I'm not sure we have quite, internalized just yet quite what that means. So, again, you're absolutely right. You know, for good and ill, and there's been a lot of ill, but there's also been a lot of good. You know, the fate of the two countries has been intertwined, you know, probably since the 13th century, you know, which is quite a long time. And this is the first time, really, in all of that period when you can say that actually these two countries are on different trajectories, you know. And Ireland has made a choice, you know. It wasn't a formal choice, but almost nobody in Ireland thought that Ireland should follow the United Kingdom out of the European Union. That was actually a choice about independence, you know. This is one of the strange things, that in England, particularly, Brexit is seen as an independence movement. In Ireland, not doing an Irish version of Brexit is seen as the expression of Irish independence. You know, we're an independent country now because we make our own decisions. And one of the decisions we make is that we're not tied to Britain, and we are going to deepen and continue our relationship with Europe. And that's a very big thing, you know. We still live very much in an Anglophone world. I mean, what complicates this is the relationship with America, which is so close. You know, we will remain Anglophone. We'll remain part of that. What used to be called the Anglo-Saxon sphere is going to have to be called something else, I think, now. Maybe the Irish-American world, you know. But, you know, just to take a real example of this, I mean, Who's America's best English-speaking friend in the European Union now? You know, that's not a question you would even have asked 5 years ago. It's obviously Britain, you know, the special relationship and all the historical ties. And Joe Biden, who I think is a person now of some consequence, I'm given to understand, in the United States, you know. I mean, Biden said a couple of years ago, he was talking about Brexit. He said one of the big problems with Brexit is that, you know, we as Americans are losing our voice within Europe, because that was the Brits. Who's going to be the voice of America in the European Union? Well, you know, Ireland. I'm not saying it's going to replace the special relationship with Britain, which has all sorts of military and security implications, you know, which of course Ireland is not really involved with. But politically speaking, you know, maybe the country in the European Union that understands America best is Ireland, and maybe the country in the European Union that has the closest historical ties still to the United States is Ireland. So Ireland's position as a sort of, you know, I don't want to overstate this, but, you know, as a sort of medium between the European Union and the United States is certainly going to become more important. But also Ireland's Europeanness is going to become more important. I mean, it has sort of pinned its colours to the European flag now, and that, as you said, it's going to have huge implications. As you know, where do your students go? Just a really simple example. One of the great programs the European Union has been running for 20 years is a thing called the Erasmus program, which means that basically, if you're a student in Dublin, you can study in Copenhagen. If you're a student in Milan, you can study in Berlin, but you can also study in Dublin or Cork or Galway. It's a fantastic program, and it really gives, you know, it just gives students, it's they don't have to pay anything extra. You know, they can move between European universities. It has a huge impact on people's lives, on who they marry. I'm 62. I have two sons. They both of their girlfriends. One of them is Danish and one of them is Spanish. You know, my one grandson is in Copenhagen. You know, his mother's Danish. You know, this is stuff that happens in real life. You know, it's not big politics, but it's very profound in terms of people's sense of who they are and how they connect. So it is one of the paradoxes of Brexit that it's definitely going to make Ireland a more European country.
We're turning back to what you said about the United States. You can't help but be struck when you travel through Ireland to see all the American corporate names and U.S. familiar corporate offices. A lot of commercial activity went to the United Kingdom after EU membership. Because Americans saw that as the soft option for getting into the EU. Now that's not going to be the case anymore. Will Ireland get some of that action, or does geography stand in the way of that?
I think Ireland will get a lot of that action. As you say, you already have huge hubs of American-owned companies in Ireland, and this is a relationship which really goes back to the 1960s, but it's particularly from the 1990s. If you go around Dublin, you know, you will just think of an American tech company and you will see their European headquarters in in Ireland. You know, it'd be very, you know, it'd be much easier to list the ones that don't. The same with areas like pharmaceuticals, like medical devices, which is incredibly important. I mean, you know, Pfizer, for example, that's a hugely important hub in County Cork. So it's already a huge factor in the Irish economy and in Irish society. And so we know, as a matter of fact, that American corporations are very comfortable in Ireland. You know, some of this is for taxation reasons, which will be controversial and rightly so. But some of it is cultural, legal. Remember, you know, Ireland and Britain had this advantage too. Of course, operates a legal system, which is pretty similar to the American. We share common law, British common law, of course, the history of that, which you know about. So, you know, there are lots of reasons, and of course the language, but you know, there's just kind of people feel comfortable in if you're Pfizer or you're Apple or you're Twitter, you know, your employees are going to feel reasonably at home if they're in Ireland. So I think it's inevitable that you know, those kind of investment decisions are often very, it's a very fine balance, isn't it? You know, most European countries, Western European countries, are highly sophisticated. They've got lots of educated populations. They've lots of good things going for them. And so it's buying things about convenience. You know, is it easier? And it's a hell of a lot easier if you're an American company, but also say if you're an Australian company or a Canadian company, you know, to base yourself in Ireland as your European base, but then the natural, easy, simple thing to do before might have been to be in England. So I think over time, Ireland will gain. You know, the short term is very difficult, but it's hard to see how there's not a significant economic upside for Ireland over the next 20 years.
Has it been an adjustment to do all this, all the things we've been talking about over the last minutes, in the midst of the COVID pandemic? Has that added sort of a layer of complication and brinksmanship to this whole thing that, you know, would have been hard under any circumstances, but this just makes it all weirder?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure it does, yeah. You know, it's a strange thing, right, isn't it? You know, I this is just pure speculation on my part, but I just have the feeling that Brexit would never have happened, you know, if it was post-COVID. I think COVID has changed the world and changed attitudes and changed people's sense of what's important to a degree that I'm not sure the Brexit fever would ever really have taken hold in the way that it did in 2016. I also think that there would not have been a deal done at the last minute if it were not for COVID, because there's no question but that COVID just put enormous pressure on Boris Johnson and on the British government. You know, they just didn't have the bandwidth. Understandably, I mean, you know, I'm not critical of them. You know, to deal simultaneously with the COVID crisis and with a looming Brexit crisis that a no deal Brexit would have brought. You know, the last thing you want when you're in the middle of a pandemic is to have your shops empty because the food that's coming in from Europe can't get through Dover. You know, so I think it played a huge part in forcing the British to sort of make a deal, which is a pretty bad deal actually. You know, but from an Irish perspective, the fact that a deal was made was really important, you know, because, again, we would have been the ones who would have suffered most from a kind of chaotic no deal. So there is the relief. I think there's you know, if you're in government, if you're in any kind of public administration, not having to deal with the Brexit thing, at least for the immediate future, is just an enormous relief. And hopefully it means that, you know, while we concentrate more on trying to get the vaccine rolled out and trying to deal with the COVID crisis, but thereafter also, you know, it just frees up space to start thinking about other ordinary things about government and about society and about where Ireland should be going.
A lot of our listeners may not realize that you also write extensively. A big part of your job is writing about the arts, and that is a potent economic factor in Ireland. Also a great Irish export. What has the COVID pandemic meant to that part of Irish life?
Oh, it's been absolutely devastating, you know. You know, I'm sure, you know, I know it's the same everywhere, but as you say, it has a big place in Irish life, you know, and the fact that live performance has effectively just been completely turned off. And this is everything from, you know, the Abbey Theatre or, you know, the opera, you know, the big things. But almost more, I think people miss, I mean, as you know, from having been here, you know, the sociability is tied up a lot with music, for example, with, you know, traditional music. If you go to the pub, there's, you know, probably a really good traditional band playing. And that's really part of the sociability, you know, and the fact that the band can't play anymore, the fact that, you know, that whole sort of level of cultural engagement, anything to do with being there, you know, has just been switched off. And it's been devastating, obviously, primarily for the artists, you know, but also I think for the rest of the society, that people really, really, really miss it, you know. It's a funny business, you know. The two things people haven't been able to do is go to mass or go to a live cultural event. And 20 years ago, you would have said missing mass would have been by far the biggest thing. And I think, and this is not disparaging in any way, of course, the fact that huge numbers of people really do miss their weekly religious service. But I think people almost miss even more, you know, the sociability of cultural life.
Fenton, one last question before we go. What does America look like in Ireland right now? We've come through some tumultuous years under Donald Trump. Your people have turned on their televisions to see mobs rampaging through the seat of our national legislature, calls for the president to be removed or to quit. What does America, a potent place in the Irish mind, look like in Ireland right now?
I think there's very deep disturbance, you know, and anxiety, because, you know, people criticize American policy quite rightly sometimes, you know, and it's not like, you know, everybody thinks that everything America does is fantastic. But, you know, for hundreds of years, for Irish people, America has been a sort of a constant, you know, a rock, a point of reference, a point of refuge, very often for people. A society that people deeply admire, you know, and are very influenced by, you know, for obvious reasons, you know, it's these very, very strong historical ties. And I think there's been a terrible sadness, you know, watching the way things have been really over the last 4 years and the culmination of that in this very direct assault on American democracy, you know. I mean, if America stands for anything in the world, you know, it stands for the idea of republican democracy, I mean, small or republican, I mean, you know, of this inspiring idea. And I know it was qualified and hypocritical in terms of slavery and in terms of exclusion and all the rest of it, but the basic idea, you know, that government of the people, by the people, for the people, you know, really matters in the world, you know. And to see this spectacle, really, of and just speaking for myself, it's not, to be honest, it's not even a sort of mob rampaging, you know, that happens, and it's terrible, but it's the fact that there are significant numbers of people within the system, you know, on the inside, you know, who are elected representatives, who think it's okay to play games with the result of an election, you know, to sort of talk about disenfranchising tens of millions of people, to disrespect the vote. You know, it's such a fundamental value. And it's a value, of course, that America promulgates abroad, you know. I mean, it's just hardly a week goes by, but I mean, quite rightly, and you know, but that you have American diplomats issuing statements about the conduct of elections and free and fair elections and respecting democracy elsewhere, you know. And it would be a very, very dark day if the United States ended up as an ally of the enemies of democracy. I don't think that's going to happen, but I think people have been shocked out of complacency about it and realized that there's a struggle for the reassertion of basic democratic values, of which I think, you know, not just the Irish, but the Europeans need to be very strongly allied with those in the United States, and which is clearly the majority who really want to preserve those democratic values. I think we've all been shocked out of our complacency and realized that if we take this stuff for granted, it's gone. You know, if a Republican democracy matters, it matters enough to fight for it every day.
Fintan O'Toole is a columnist and drama critic for the Irish Times. He joined us from Ireland. Great to talk to you, Fintan.
A real pleasure.
You've been listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Yun. Our program is produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, First Republic Bank, and Chevron. We want to hear from you. What did you think about this episode? What topics would you like us to cover in 2021? Our email address is feedback@worldaffairs.org. This episode was produced by Jared Sport and Teresa Katsarilis. Joanne Jennings is our executive producer. Ray Suarez co-hosted. Temba Daniels provided research support. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for listening.